Hello everyone. Today I have Constantine, a project manager and a person who started in Q&A, a great guy. We talked about project management, we talked about games, the latest, and I think it's a worthwhile conversation, even if you're not interested in project management. I think it makes kind of sense to know what they're expecting, and how their job is structured and their perspective. I think this could be valuable for anybody, honestly. So yeah, I think I will let you guys see it now. I'll get out of your hair, and I hope you enjoy it. Don't forget to subscribe. Leave a like and let me know what you think about the episode in the comments. All right.
Constantine, I'm a project manager at Wargaming, doing some stuff at game development, and we'll try to cover any possible related to management questions and stuff.
Okay, so what would you say is the perception of your job versus what it actually is?
Okay, so the first thing people ask me about what am I doing at my job is probably like the the most frequent answers or perceptions is, are you're doing updates, meetings, schedule some updates for leadership, maybe sending some emails, maybe establishing communication stuff. It's kind of true, but it's not. But if we want to dive a bit deeper, it's all about communication, priorities, aligning scope with people. For example, if we are talking about AAA projects, we have a multiple people and multiple teams and stuff. People can do game design, other team can do art, another one can do level design and stuff like that. And it's all about creating a game and unifying all those efforts towards one united goal. It's sort of difficult, but you can, as a project manager, you can approach that from different angles, through the communication, of course, through the pipelines and stuff, like establishing the processes, how exactly we are going to create things and stuff.
Hey there, sorry to interrupt. Just quickly, if you're really enjoying this episode, leave a like and a subscribe. It really helps out with the content and with the channel generally. It helps me make this more often. And let me hear from you in the comments. Like, I have no idea who's watching this, so I would love to hear from you. It motivates me to keep going. And, if you don't have time today to watch this, keep it in the Watch for Later playlist. I really appreciate that. All right, I'll leave you to the episode right now. I hope you enjoyed.
Yeah, do managing, planning, budgeting, and stuff. There are different sorts of management people, for example, producers, managers like me, development directors, and stuff. All of them kind of the same, but also not, because, for example, it's different layers of management. For example, a producer is someone who drives the project, drives the idea, drives the features from the beginning till the release and stuff. And managers more about how exactly we are gonna do this feature and this project and this, for example, DLC. It's all about processes. It's all about how exactly, which in what timeline, with what resources and stuff. So it's kind of this level of details.
So let's try to give an example for people who are listening and have no idea what you're kind of like talking about here. So let's say it's a project, it's a game project about I don't know, RTS World War III, whatever, right? That is the general idea. Is that a layer of management that needs to keep that scope in line? And then another layer of management that needs to keep like the art and the programming, the sprints. What is the difference between that and a producer? Like, let's take that example and like flush it out and talk about details.
So all projects, all game projects specifically, started from the idea, and this idea fulfills with some sort of details through the way of creating and developing the project itself. So when we have an idea, we can start concepting it, planning it and stuff like that. So we are, as a project, starting from the game design owner or creative director who said, I want to create, for example, this game about war and stuff. And that's where first requirements are coming, and that's where we can start planning our work and concepting things. For example, with this idea, we can start working on concepts. Then we can test them, or then we can develop this idea into something else, or connect this idea to another idea. For example, we can touch this topic of war-related content, and then we can expand it, I don't know, till the space wars. Just something happened.
Yeah.
Creative
yeah.
director just realized we can do space wars too. And that's where we starting to get our first scope, and that's where we can plan the resources, how big team is, and who exactly is going to do this, that, and this. And yep. it's sort of different from the project to project, but the structure is roughly the same. We have pre-concept stage, developing stage, QA stage, and release stage. It's all about creating a game, but with from different angles, of course. And yes, we have, for example, separated stage for QA, but it doesn't mean we don't do QA throughout the whole process, because for example, on a concept stage, we need to prepare a client for a demo, a build for a demo, or something else. And the same goes for project management. We are always there and trying to align people, trying to align goals and stuff, because without proper prioritization and without proper communication within the team, there will be definitely scope creep. Actually, communication is so valuable. People sometimes do not see it, but communication is the thing which either can help your project succeed or destroy it completely. For example, when you're working on AAA project, probably your team is so big, so some of them located in USA, for example. Another part of the team is in Europe and stuff. And now we have time zones, and now we have to align different people from different cultures with different background. And that's all about what good project managers should do. And we can use variety of techniques. We can use different approaches. It's all about soft skills. Soft skills are also a really vital thing for us. And so it's hard skills, for example, can give you a job, like if you're a developer. But soft skills, it's a thing which will help you to succeed in your job. And for project managers, it's kind of reversed, so to say, because soft skills, for us, it's a hard skills. And without soft skills, without the ability to talk with people, it's you will not succeed probably at this job. You have to find the approaches to people. You have to find to see the situation from different angles and have an empathy towards different people. And it's a skill, and you have to train it. And I'm trying to just explain from different points what project managers are doing. And of course, different project managers in different fields are completely different roles, because for example, I can't say anything about banking and those kind of project management, but it's probably not that fun, without no offense, as for example, doing your work related to creative assets and stuff. Why do I prefer this particular role in game development? Just because purely you are surrounded with creative people from all over the place, like art, Terhart, VFX, audio and stuff. And all of them are so passionate about doing their part. And it's always, I feel grateful for being there and working with them on something really meaningful, which is actually tangible for the players. You're doing something that people will see, people will touch, play it, and see the visuals, hear the audio, feel the experience from the game. And this is so cool. Like the outcome deliverable is so meaningful. And when you release your game and when you or a project or a feature, you do not stop there because that's where operation phase is coming. And now you have to maintain and maintain your game and fix, for example, bugs from production. Talk with community about maybe we can do something better and do another feature or create a DLC for the players. It's all about still management and helping project stay alive.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's a truly a generalist skill to have. Like you need to be kind of good at everything. What would you say is the number one skills beyond communication that you think is specific for project management in games that is necessary? Like, for example, I would imagine playing games or being a fan of games is important, right?
This is actually another most popular answer from people I hear sometimes, like, what are you doing in game development? Probably you're playing games. Yes and no. So yeah, you have to be passionate about games, of course, because without that, why are you doing this? Like, it doesn't worth your time, probably. Yes, you have to love games. You have to understand the market because it's crucial. Because if you don't understand the technologies and like what people want, like what player want right now, you probably will lose this sense of, I don't know, importancy, so to say, of your work. So you might lose in interest. So yeah, it's a vital thing. And of course, we are playing our games because you can't work on something you don't like or you don't know. And for project manager in game development, it's really crucial for me to understand what am I doing. Because, for example, I can work with variety of teams. Again, VFX or tech art teams or art teams, and all of those teams are working on different things. For example, some of the teams might work on meshes and effects and explosions and stuff. Other team is working on purely audio related stuff. Game design is working on layers of maps and objects and how exactly we should place a specific tower and how much damage this thing should deal and stuff like that. And you as a project manager should know at least basics of all of those things. It doesn't mean that you have to learn VFX. No, it's not about that. You need to understand the specifics of works because it will eventually help you to coordinate your work, to talk with people, estimate the efforts, and have a general understanding of when and how exactly something will be created. Because without that, you will not succeed in planning, budgeting, in team creation, and all of
Honestly,
those sort of
like
things.
it helps a lot to if the project manager knows a little bit about VFX because like
Yeah.
VFX is such a broad term and even the people who work in VFX do different things. And
Yeah.
it helps a lot if the project manager knows, for example, like although VFX is a art, like it's part of the art pipeline, it is basically its own pipeline. And because we do art, yes, that is correct. We have to talk to art leads, but we also need to talk to tech leads, and we need to get the tools sometimes from the tech leads. Meaning, we need access to the project. We need to work within the project. We need Git access or perforce, right? And if the project manager does not know about that, have not calculated for like another perforce access license, whatever. It can get really time consuming, and it takes a really good VFX artist to know what to do in between the time until they get access. And yeah, so just more like to emphasize your point, it is so important to know a little bit about everything.
Project managers are there purely to unblock the team. So I could describe the best way I could describe myself here is I'm basically unblocking like really cool professionals to do their work, and they don't have to deal with all of sorts communication and thinking about managing and stuff like that. I am doing that part. I am holding the chaos while you're doing your work. Like, this is my role here.
What would you say is the most underutilized role of project manager? Like people who work with you would wish they reached out to you for a certain thing. Would you say there's that one thing that you feel like you need to tell people, please reach out to me if you need to book a meeting or if you need XYZ?
I would say that's actually an interesting question. I would say I really wish people could pay more attention to risks, because project manager is also doing contingency plans and backup plans for any possible case. Because I think, from my perspective, I might be wrong, but the most difficult part for the professionals like artists and coders is to estimate their work, not because they don't know what they are doing or so. It's just because sometimes requirements might change. Sometimes we might have another priority or anything, and people tend to not keeping in mind those tiny things which could possibly delay your project and your work. And they do not, and I mean, they don't have to do contingency plans and stuff. If they do, that's cool. But you are, as project manager, should be responsible for that, and you should have those plans in place. Because if you will not save space, for example, like in the middle of your sprint or so, probably your deliverable will be delayed, and that means that you will have to talk with the leadership about why we didn't make it in time, because you just didn't make a contingency plan. So if I would say, if people could talk more with me about their problems, any possible related risks or bottlenecks they have right now, that would be cool. And I don't mean they don't do that. They do, but sometimes it's just thing which is pops in my head sometimes.
I think it's also like a weird. I mean, no one kind of onboard you as an artist or as a person that is working, right? Because, like, where are my responsibilities stopping? When are they not? Some people are shy to report, like, I have nothing to do this week. And it's like, why? There's things you have to kind of teach, or you kind of need to make checkups or systems for checkups. Yeah, because
That
people
depends
sometimes,
on.
like, they don't talk unless you ask, right?
That's true, and that depends on, I guess, seniority of different people. For example, my work is really different from when, for example, I work in with senior or principal programmer and stuff, because that's where I unblocking them. That's what I mentioned previously. That's where I just unblock people and let them do their stuff. But with more junior people, it's about more management, and I mean that in a good way. Like, you have to have those checkups just to understand if he's doing all right, like if everything is okay and you can count on him or anything. Or maybe he has some problem with communication, as you said, or maybe he has some problem with tools, and he's shy to just ask people about stuff because he doesn't know those people yet.
How do you deal with the maybe loud personalities within a team that might cause conflicts because of the way they talk or the way they are? It's nothing against them, of course, but it might rub people the wrong way. How do you deal with conflicts like that?
I don't think, first of all, yeah, I don't think there is a hard person to work with for me. I think each person, I can find approach to that person. It's just the matter of time. And I mean, let's say you mentioned loud person and it ruins and destroys vibes and stuff. Well, it's all starting from communication with this person, and maybe identifying maybe there is a problem, maybe something is happening on the background and I don't see that.
Oh,
Maybe he is
that's
not
good.
happy with Yeah, maybe he's not happy with some sort of leadership decisions. And the majority of such situations are all about lack of information. Like this person probably doesn't know ABC, or it's me who don't know some things. And usually after several talks, it's all right. But if we are talking about like really negative person, like he is here not to work, he is here just to destroy everything. I don't have a opportunity to work with people like this yet,
I think
luckily.
the hiring
But
process filters a lot of those people out.
But I would say my way of resolving that issue, if I would understand that this is the case, I would probably set a meeting for me, this person, and his principal or lead, just to discuss
Gotcha.
how we can resolve this issue. Yeah, it's just all about having someone more experienced in that particular field, just to discuss this stuff.
That is also another thing where your connection, like, here's the thing, you're only one person, and if you're the team you're working with is like 50 to 100 people, you probably are not talking to each one individually. You're probably doing your communication over the leads, right? So, question to you is like, what do you expect from your lead artist or programmer? Do you expect them to be the most experienced person on a team, or do you expect them to know enough but communicate very well?
From leads, I usually expect proactiveness, and that's basically it. I think, again, I'm lucky enough to work with really talented people, and I didn't have any chance to see like people who do not really understand what they are doing, and they are leads. So, I would say the most vital thing for me from the leads would be proactive. That's cool when you don't reach out first, and it's not a constant thing. Like, when you have to tell or to ask the same questions again and again, the same particular person, the whole week, it's not cool.
Yeah, gotcha.
Like, plainly speaking. But when the leads, for example, collaborating with you, that's another level of work. That's where you can create something, and not that's where management is not a tool to like to manage people. That's where it's just tool to make your life easier, like to, I don't know, clear the field of Jira and uncertainty in processes.
Yeah, I mean, here's another question. What kind of tool or technique you wish someone had taught you in the beginning, but you figured out on your own?
I would say it's so it's difficult for me because I didn't become a project manager from the beginning. First, I was a QA tester, and I was kind of already with a pack of tools and stuff, so it was not really completely a new world for me when I started to a project management. But if I would think about a particular thing which I was lacking of, it was Jira, yeah, because it's really different from when you use Jira as a QA tester, for example, or a developer, because the only one thing you need to know how to do is create bugs, issues, log your time and stuff. But when you're a project manager, it's another level. You have to create dashboards, you have to create graphics and stuff, collect data, because if you want to succeed at your work, you have to make decisions based on data. And in order to collect this data, you have to master this tool. So yeah, it's really big, it's really wide tool to work with, and it helps you to get together all sorts of data. And with these GQL filters and stuff, you just can actually grab anything from the project. But side note, it works only when people manage their work, because if people do not log their time and do not do their stuff, it will probably not work.
What do you do when someone is not logging their information? Do you just put the reminder for them, or
I think putting reminders and asking people constantly about that is good, but I think more efficient ways of creating this culture is to work on this culture. You need to explain people why we are doing this and why it's so important for us. For example, when you just started your project, like creating something, like a game or a feature, it doesn't matter, without proper estimations, you will not have data to realize when exactly this work will be done. And this is not only project manager skill or any, it's just skill which is useful for everybody. That way you cannot estimate how you're doing at your work because you don't have estimates. So if you log your time and you're explaining that to people why we are doing this and why it's crucial, that works. So I usually start from the beginning. Like, probably people just have questions or don't know how to. I have people who work who work with me in one project, and they sometimes asking me questions, how do I log time, like after 3 years of working together, and I'm like, oh wow, that's cool. I'm glad you asked.
Oh my god. But you know, estimations are tricky. Like, yeah, one estimation for one project is different for another project. I guess the more you work, sure, on one project, like if you do sequels or DLCs, the better the estimations are. What do you do, yeah, if it's like a completely new estimation? I heard about some techniques that one can use, like making a small cycle.
Yeah, yeah. So you iterate. It's you can either iterate, make your deliverable. You can divide your huge deliverable into smaller chunks and see on each step how much time do you spend on that. And it also helps you with planning stuff and etc. Or you can estimate your work not in hours or days. You can estimate that in t-shirt, for example. It's a technique called t-shirt sizing, if I'm correct. So it's basically can be large, small, or medium. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be. You just define on the basic level what large, medium, and small is. Mm. For example, large is 3 months and small is 1 month of work. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of working. It helps. It doesn't give you a precise amount of work, but it still gives you a high picture of when exactly and what.
Man, that's such a hard job, honestly, like, to be a project manager. Yeah. Like, the overview you have to have. Also, a lot of responsibility. Like, it kind of falls all on you if you think about it, right?
Yeah, sometimes you can just drone in all of this work, and the only one thing which helps me to sustain the same level of sanity is to have a plan for each day. It can be just a plan in your notebook, for example. Mm. You just write down a to-do list. For example, today I will be working on this and that. And that works. That's enough. That's cool. And I'm actually cheating because sometimes people tend to ask me questions completely not related to me at all. And I just sometimes don't do anything about that because it's not related to me. And in 30 minutes, it can be just be resolved without me. And I'm like, cool.
Perfect.
Doing it. Oh, cool. Yeah. So that's how it works. I don't do that with crucial projects, but sometimes people can ask me questions about, I don't know, who is responsible for creating this roadmap. I don't know. I don't know. It's not my field.
Yeah, no, I gotcha. I have a question, and that is something I experienced a lot on teams. And that is the fact that the tech team is always incredibly busy with stuff, right?
Yes.
Asking them for more work is just not going to happen, right?
Yeah.
How do you deal with such bottlenecks? And is it common for tech teams to always be like,
yeah, of
in
course,
that position?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Yeah, of course, everybody. Everybody is busy because we don't have much time. I don't know why, but just how it works. It just, I don't know, the world we're living in. Maybe it's a bad planning, but I'm not sure because all project I was working on past 5 years are the same, and it's just how it works. But when I need something from someone, yeah, it's just, it comes down to the communication one more time. And if I can ask someone to do something for me, for example, we need this feature to be supported by tech team. And it's all about planning, and you have to do it in advance. If you don't do it in advance and coming to your tech team and asking them, oh, wow, I have a deadline like tomorrow, can you just please do this and that? No, of course not. Of course, of course, they will not do that. Or they will, but they will hate you. And yeah, but you just need to plan your work. And it's really sometimes hard because you can miss something. It's not that obvious to you, but the tool which can help you to resolve that, again, it's communication. You just need to talk with people and understand the direction of the project. So yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, it's such a tricky topic. I had a question, but it just flew out of my mind. But here's another one then. You mentioned you were involved on a project like from its prototyping phase, right?
Yeah.
So that is basically a no budget decision. Like, you might have a budget to experiment with, but not an actual production budget, right?
It depends on what... Yeah, again, it depends on type of project you are working in, and it depends on what the prototype is, because the prototype can be something physical. For example, you can use a carton boxes and create something, and that's it, like, to just to show the map, for example.
Yeah.
Or it can be fully functional hub for your vehicle, where you can use different modes for snow stuff or rain stuff. It's just all comes down to the budgeting. But you can have a prototype without any sort of budget. Yes, that's true.
Which phase of a project would you say is the most exciting, other than release? I mean, I know it's stressful, but
my favorite one. Oh, okay. Yeah, I think my favorite one is prototyping.
I thought so too.
Like pre-production. Yeah, because that's where you establish art direction. That's where you establish... You're still discovering things. You're still in a bit of chaos. But you're already doing something. And you kind of see the light at the end of the tunnel. Because you see the... You're starting to see the scope of work. You're starting to see the team with whom you're working at and on this project. And you can see the results of your work. Like, for example, when you prototype, you understand what are you doing right now. So it's kind of cool to see the results, to prototype new things. And yeah, I would say this is the favorite one, because release one is cool as well, but it's still work. Yes, this is the part where you have champagne and confetti, but this is also the most stressful part, because that's where your project is visible for people. That's where the cost of failure and mistakes is much higher than in previous. I don't say that it's not that bad to make mistakes during development. No, it is still. But here you will have a platform or players who will judge you for that, or it might affect your, for example, Steam reviews and stuff. So yeah, this is kind of really tricky.
I think game development is like one of the most cruel industries when it comes to like perceptions of players or of users, because a lot of projects are just hidden behind a curtain, and you know, you're working on it at one point you're just forgetting what you're doing, or you don't know how good you've been cooking or how bad you've been cooking. You've just become tasteless at one point because you've been seeing the same stuff all over and over again, and so there's a confirmation bias that is happening, right? Everybody on the team loves the game, but that doesn't mean that the players will come to play the game as natural as the testing team are, or whatever, right? And that is cruel. A movie, maybe you can release a teaser while you're recording it, just to test the waters if people are hyped on it or not. But games, they are teasers, they are trailers and all, but like, it is already that far into development, because games are just way more complex.
It's unpredictable. I mean, the sentiment of the players, and unfortunately the amount of efforts you do as a project, as a team, sometimes will not correlate with the outcome of work, and it's not because your game is bad, it's just maybe not the right time, and I don't know, just just things happen.
There's a lot of like sentiments between gamers and game developers sometimes I see online where like they're constantly almost fighting, you know, like, yeah, you can't criticize my game, and then they're like, well, who's gonna criticize your game? And it's like,
we at Wargaming, we love all kind of players because everybody is valuable and we appreciate everything. We appreciate players playing our game. That's cool. From my experience, when I was working at when I was working with collaborations, like I was doing collaboration work with different IPs and stuff, that's where it comes much more difficult, because when you incorporate foreign IP, for example, in your game, and this particular IP has its own fan base, this is the most like precise critics you will see, because these people do care about the IPs. Yes, they care about everything, and the amount of details and everything, they are paying really close attention on what you're doing. And this is really difficult to satisfy those kind of players. But at the same time, when you do that, it's the most precious thing you can do, because when you see those critics are actually like your game, your content, that's insanely cool. That's proves that you're doing good.
it just proves that from the early decision of accepting this to the final decision of like finishing, the last like brush stroke has been correct, right? Has been on point.
That's unbelievable feelings.
And it's there is no draw or like almost success or almost failure. There's either black and white, right, with people or with gamers.
I don't know. I mean, all players are different. Obviously, I'm not the person who can talk from the community perspective side, but I think me as a player, I can say from my experience, me as a player, I don't do bad Steam reviews, only good. So I would say I'm on the right side of things. So maybe there is some sort of divide in between people and players, but I don't know.
I'm not like disagreeing with people who review games, or I don't know, like everybody is entitled to their opinion. I don't really agree also with the sentiment of like game developers should censor criticism just because they're so in love with what they do, and that is, I think those are two different things. I get it, you put passion, you put a lot of love, and listen, good for you, and I know it's tough, and you might not even make any financial gains from this, but it has nothing to do with if people perceived it well or not well. That is something, that's a completely different topic in a way. Like, there's also factors like not just age, but like the time that we live in. Like, how many artists were too early for their times, right?
You're right. Every feedback, like negative feedback, it can be constructive or not, but when we're talking about constructive feedback, it's also always cool, of course, and welcomed, and we would like to improve our game as much as we can, and that's why we have focus groups and play testers, like beta testers, alpha testers, and stuff like that. That's why we are doing that. But again, the market is so unpredictable right now. You just don't know whether this game will succeed or not, or to what extent this game will succeed. Because, for example, I'm not sure if we can mention specific titles here, but for example, if we're talking about Expedition 33, no one heard anything about that before it's released. So maybe someone, I don't know, but I didn't heard anything about that. And when it's released, it's like, boom, game of the year.
There's like this in social science, right? Like, it says, so I can link you to anybody in the world through 6 connections, right?
Yeah.
It's so crazy how connected we are. So when you make a game so good and you can recommend it to people, like it spreads kind of like a pandemic in a way.
Yeah.
It goes
Like a
around,
labubu.
and then, like, if you recommend it for three people, the three people might recommend it to five, and then the five will recommend it to 15. You see how this spreads, and a good game will spread, and that is the fact. A good game that resonates with people, with the luck, of course. There's a lot of luck factor in it. If you catch the right people at the right time, I don't know what it is. Like, I can't really put success down on a paper, but.
Yeah, but sometimes we have also examples, worldwide recognized examples like Cyberpunk, where the game was really roughly released, so to say, but it became better through time. So now I guess it's like hilarious game, and I would like to play it again and again because it's just cool. But first release was really rough, and yeah, I mean, you can't predict
I
anything.
mean, that's a game that there's literally nothing like it. Like, there's no competition almost for Cyberpunk, or at the time of its release. So that's why games like Cyberpunk or No Man's Sky, there's not really a lot of competition going on. So players don't really have a choice. So if they fix it eventually, there's more mercy. Like, there's more margin of failure there. Then there is, like, I don't think the same is true when it comes to, like, I don't know, a Far Cry clone. Or now, especially, like, you see a lot of those games, right? Like the Lethal Company clones. I don't think there's a margin of failure there, because you either are good and you're expanding the genre, or you're imitating, and why should I play your
Copy.
game while I could just play Lethal Company type of thing, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I totally agree. And also, I would highlight that that's great when developers and teams have the opportunity to improve their game even after, for example, rough releases and stuff. That's cool because some of the games and game developers do not have such privilege, and sometimes projects can be shut down, not even on the release stage during development, and it's just the reality we are
Yeah.
living in right now. That's rough.
Like, I kind of wish that there was a law or something that says if you cancel a project, you have to give all the open source code to everybody.
Because sometimes I heard something about several projects I was interested in, and they were canceled between like a few years between prototyping and releasing stages, and I wish someone could just buy those assets because the idea is great, and I don't know, everything is great, and I would like to play this game, and I wish someone could buy it and finish the game. That would be nice.
I agree with you there. I mean, how many games that you really enjoyed that made zero money whatsoever? And, like, it is just sad in a way, and, like, we need to figure this stuff out. I don't know. I feel like there's, like, not every game needs to be a Fortnite, you know what I mean? Like,
Yeah, that's true.
there's enough money, I feel, to be made from franchises that were forgotten, like Command and Conquer, RTSs, like the classics. Like, we don't see that as much.
Sometimes, for example, you can change the strategy of your monetization plan. I might be wrong again, but I heard somewhere that the Ark Raiders game was initially considered as free-to-play open world something game, but it's eventually become a extraction shooter. So the developers just reconsider their opportunities, I guess, and stuff, and that's cool that they finished that.
Yeah.
I'm glad they didn't cancel it because it's a great game.
I haven't played it yet. Would you? Did you play it?
Yes, definitely. I mean, promotion time. I'm joking.
Yeah, of course.
Whenever I heard that from, I didn't heard anything about that, and my friends were playing this game for a while, like for 2 or 3 days, and they called me just to join
Cool.
and see how it goes, and I was like, yeah, cool, whatever. And I joined that without no expectations, and I didn't even know at that time what was going on there. Like, what is this? Like, extraction shooter, cool. There is a plenty of those, so I just it surprised me.
Yeah.
And I was surprised because it's simple, but at the same time it's immersive, and for this particular stage, it full of content and stuff. I'm still, after playing this the whole week, I'm still investigating things. I
That's
still trying
cool.
to understand what's going on there. Yeah, there are some things you can do, and for the state of things, like for the released project, that's enough for me. And I'm eager to know what they will make from it, like what exactly, what meta would be, what DLCs would be, because the potential of this game is great. Because when I see those gigantic robots doing some sort of shenanigans on the background of the map, that's insanely cool.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I'm also a huge fan of the price of the game, like the 40 instead of the 60. I'm just such a huge fan of games reducing their prices, respecting the idea that people can't really find money to buy grocery like these days. So reduce the price means a lot. Like I can tell you this game 2019 would have been 60 euros easily, right? Like $60. Yeah, and now it's 40 like euros. That is amazing.
I think that's because game developers and big companies seeing the changes in the market, and you can see that small team, for example, like the team who was working on Expedition 33, it was not that big. It was not like AAA company or
Yeah.
something. It was like a small group of enthusiasts who decided to create a great game, and they did.
Yeah.
And the cost of the development, I don't know, but I think it was less than AAA something. I
Yeah.
don't know.
With like the massive teams. Yeah,
So
of course.
I think people upstairs see the changes, and probably they just adapt the products and prices and stuff.
That is interesting, like with all the waves of layoffs, that could be an interesting reason why this is happening. You can definitely get similar mileage from juniors these days, than from like, which is sad, of course, nothing, but the world is changing and we can't do much about it. I really like what Exhibition 33 did with like hiring juniors and yeah,
Yeah,
bringing
I
them
heard the
up.
story. Yeah, I heard the story that they how did they find the audio composer or so? It was just somebody just was scrolling the some sort of music services and found an artist who did a great samples and music and stuff, and he just messaged her if she's interested in some sort of
Cool.
working with on this game, and she was like, "Yeah, cool."
Let's do
I'm not
it.
sure if that story is true, but if that's true, that's insane. I
Yeah.
like that. Yeah, that's how it should be created. That's how we should create
Yeah.
games.
I think a lot of stories like that just don't get ever to be told, but they are very similar in the sense of like I was browsing LinkedIn or I was browsing blah 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 and I found this artist and then we reached out to them and we figured it out. I think that's a lot of the hiring, like what you see when companies put their hiring ad out there, that means they already have went through their connections. They have already asked everybody if they know anyone, because it's just way easier than to make a job description and an actual like post. Just ask around you, right? That is why can like networking, going to conferences, always showcasing your work whenever you have anything going on, posting on LinkedIn, even if you're annoying everybody on LinkedIn, it doesn't really matter. As long as you're still relevant, you're popping up on their feed every now and then. You are in their mind, or they see you, they think about you, even if it's for a microsecond. So when that opportunity comes of like, oh, we're looking for a VFX artist. Oh, I know a guy. He's always on my LinkedIn po feed, you know? Like, yeah, that's why I do the podcast. Like, that is why,
That's true.
you know?
Sometimes it's happening in
Yeah, that
the
one too. I mean, that's the not so digital version of it, right?
Yeah, that's true.
All right, listen, man, it's been amazing. Is there anything you would like to add at the end or promote? Like, where can people find you?
Yeah, Thanks for inviting me. That was a pleasure. That was my first time doing a podcast. That's cool.
Nice.
I think I was doing great
Yeah, you are. You
for
are.
me.
Yeah.
You can reach out to me on LinkedIn if you want to talk about anything. I would be happy to discuss anything. Yeah.
Absolutely. I'll leave your LinkedIn in the description below. And for everybody who's listening, if you enjoyed this so far, leave a like and subscribe. And if you didn't, I don't know why you're still watching. Let me know why you're still watching. I have no idea. But hey, see you guys in the next one. We will still talk.
Yep.
So I was just saying goodbye to the people. Bye, people.